Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the faculty lecture series. Good to see all of you here. I'm David Harrison, currently serving as Associate Provost, and it's my pleasure to help organize this lecture series, which is an opportunity for our faculty who have recently returned from funded sabbatical leave to share with the college community what they've been working on. Our lecturer today is Rick Vallely. He is the Claude C. Smith Class of 14 Professor of Political Science. He's taught at Swarthmore since fall of 1993 and previously taught at MIT. Rick has published scholarly articles in peer-reviewed journals such as the Annual Review of Political Science, Politics and Society, and Studies in American Political Development. He's the author of a number of books: American Politics, A Very Short Introduction; The Two Reconstructions, The Struggle for Black Enfranchisement, that's University of Chicago Press; and Radicalism in the States, The American Political Economy and the Minnesota Farmer Labor Party. And several of these books are so popular that they are permanently on reserve.
Where I put them.
Yes.
I had
trouble getting them myself.
Okay.
He's the author of co-editor and contributor to the Oxford Handbook of American Political Development. And in 2009, he published the Princeton Readings in American Politics. His current book project, which he's going to be talking to us about today, is titled Uncle Sam's Closet: LGBT Enfranchisement in the American State, and that will be published by the University of Chicago Press. Here at Swarthmore, Rick teaches courses on congressional, judicial, presidential, electoral, and party politics, and an honor seminar called The State of American Democracy. We're currently nearing the conclusion of LGBTQ Pride Month here at the college, and so Rick's lecture is also very timely as we think about the need to reclaim LGBTQ histories that have been erased or were never adequately researched in the first place. In this current era, when we seem to be making political and social gains only to see a rollback of some of those advances, knowing this history is so much more important, and for that reason, I'm grateful for Rick's work on this topic. Please join me in welcoming Rick Vallely.
Thank you, David, for that lovely introduction, and thank you all for coming out right before you have to go away for your Thanksgiving recess or taking time out from working on your papers that are due tonight or are due tomorrow morning or are due before you go. So it's really great that you all could come out. And this also gives me an opportunity to thank the college, which I want to do as many times as I can, but the college is really a very special place to be a scholar teacher. The college supports research and scholarship as much as a faculty member wants to devote himself or herself to it. And the library is particularly supportive, and it's great that I see Sarah Litchko and Peggy Seiden here and Pam Harris, because they've been such a huge help to me, and the library system in general has been such a huge help to me in doing the work that I've been doing over the years. And I also want to thank David for pointing out that in addition to doing this very important work of bringing faculty to come and talk about their work, also situating the work that I'm going to be talking about today in the LGBTQ Pride Month that we're in the middle of. And it gives me special pleasure to be doing a presentation in that month. And I think this is the first month that we've done this consciously at the college. And so for me, this is a wonderful and welcome change in the life of the college. So the book that I've been working on, Uncle Sam's Closet, with a subtitle LGBT Enfranchisement in the American State, starts at a certain point in time. And there's a story in the book that runs from 1945 until the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and into the present administration. David is right to emphasize that the present administration is very hostile to transgender individuals in their military service, and there may be other ways in which it's rolling back some of the gains that were made in appointments during the Obama administration. So, so one of the things I do wrestle with in the book is whether successors to Democrats freeze, reverse, or advance the status quo that they inherit. And we're in the middle of watching, going through that cycle once again. We've been through it before with Reagan, we've been through it before with George H.W. Bush, who actually was in many ways and very quietly quite gay friendly, and we've been through it with George W. Bush, who was pretty good about it too in some ways. So I found out that this was a story when I talked to the guy who had been the advisor to the Obama campaign in 2008 and had been the LGBT advisor. He's a professor at Penn Law School. And he said at the end of the interview, he said, you know, there are all these amazing changes going on in the Obama administration. I said, really? He said, yeah, there are about 300. And I said, 300? And so he then said, yeah, I can get you a list. And I said, oh, please do. Well, it turned out that there's no such thing as a list. It's very hard to track down. But once I got into it, I realized, wait a minute, this story had a beginning. And so I'm going to start with the beginning of the beginning. And that's why I've got the first slide on the screen. And there's a sudden explosion that occurs in the salience and in the importance of the sexual orientation of people who are in government service and who are in the military. And it happens in the immediate post-war period. And a way to get a sense of how the story starts out in a very small and kind of completely unnoticeable way is to take a look at a letter which was unearthed and summarized in 1965 when gay rights activists started fighting with the Civil Service Commission about its prohibitions on the service of gay men and women in the United States Civil Service. Civil Service Commission is the predecessor agency to the Office of Personnel Administration. It was founded in 1883 and during the Chester Arthur administration, and the act had for a very long time a prohibition on the service in the merit civil service of people who had engaged in infamous or immoral conduct. And when the gay activists in 1965 began to fight with the Civil Service Commission about the what I call the orientation boundary that existed in public service, the Civil Service Commission decided to figure out, wait a minute, when did we start doing this? And it turned out that they started doing it, and so you'll see here that one of the people in the commission is saying, you know, we're having this discussion, and I did some research, and what he found out is that prior to 1945, there was no policy, and then in 1945, a sheet of paper was put in the Federal Personnel Manual, which was a ring binder. There were literally hundreds of them in the archives. They went through constant changes. Sheets were always being put in. And these were sheets that examiners used and other officials used when they were trying to assess whether someone should actually be given a probationary job in the civil service of the United States. And at that time, in 1945, this letter in November was added to the manual. This is what they discovered 20 years later. And the fact that they didn't know about it is itself an important fact. It tells you that indeed, the letter that was put into the binder was really no big deal in a certain sense. And what I mean by that is that it actually couldn't have had any consequence because at the time, separately, the Oversight Committee in the House was trying to investigate whether the Civil Service Commission actually had any investigative capacity. And it issued a report, I've just taken a little snippet from it here, from the committee report that said, no, they just don't have any investigative capacity. So one way to think about what I just showed you, this letter that was put into the Federal Personnel Manual, is it's a little bit like Bishop Berkeley's tree falling in the forest, right? Somebody thought this up, they stuck it in the Personnel Manual. It's hard to see how it could have had any effect whatsoever in the immediate post-war period. And suddenly, fast forward 8 years later, and the President of the United States is giving a television address. This is Dwight D. Eisenhower. And Dwight D. Eisenhower is excited about the fact that there's television. He's excited about the fact that his press secretary, James Hagerty, has ideas about how to use this new medium to communicate. And we think of Kennedy as the first telegenic candidate. In fact, the first person to really start thinking seriously about how to use television to communicate with the American public was Dwight D. Eisenhower. And he had help, as I said, from his press secretary. And he decided that he was going to have a meeting of the cabinet on TV, and they were going to be talking in an informal way, in a kind of chat with the American public, and clearly he's channeling Roosevelt to a certain extent here with the fireside chats, about what it is that the cabinet is doing. And then in the middle of this press conference, this is happening at 9:30 at night. We don't know how many people watch this, okay? But we know that millions of people must be watching this. I mean, it can't be any more specific than that. I tried to figure out whether there was a Nielsen rating for this, and I couldn't, and it's very hard to find out. But we'll assume that a very large number of Americans in the middle of the night, there wasn't anything else to do. You didn't have MSNBC, you didn't have Rachel Maddow. You know, you didn't have any of the wonderful things that we have now, the choice that we have that polarizes us in so many ways. And so the conversation turns to the Attorney General, Herbert Brownell. Herbert Brownell is basically a good guy. How do we know that? His daughter was a political scientist, that's why. And she was president of a small liberal arts college in the Boston area. Herbert Brownell is speaking into the camera, and he's saying, well, Mr. President, we're in the business of weeding out all the security risks on the federal payrolls. And what we mean by that are people whose, well, their personal habits are such that they might be susceptible to blackmail. This is code for gay people. Okay, and we'll begin to see that that's a story in itself, why it is that this is code. It's very unclear that people who are watching this could figure out the code, except for a small number of people who have been paying attention and reading the newspaper news from Washington assiduously. Most people must have been sitting there going, huh? Personal habits? You know, what does that mean? You know, they like to walk their dog at 3 a.m. And then he adds, we believe that without fanfare, it's a very supremely confident kind of statement, we're going to be able to weed everybody out over the next few months, which is also an amazing statement. So, at the beginning of the story, 1945, there's this minor change in a manual, and 8 years later, the President of the United States is saying to the American public, I'd like you to listen to my Attorney General. Please speak. Attorney General says, we're getting rid of these people who are susceptible to blackmail. And we're going to be able to do this quickly, and we're going to be able to do it without any fanfare. This is a general, you know, rest assured, we're on the case. We really know what we're doing. And what they're doing is they're implementing an executive order that had just been made effective in May, and it was issued in April. And the executive order starts out, this is a little known executive order, although for people who know who are into this historiography, it's an important milestone. And the president writes on the basis of language that was probably drafted for him by Warren Burr. So some people I work with at the Mattachine Society in Washington, which is this gay rights organization, have a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit, and they're trying to figure out whether Warren Burr really did it, did the drafting. I tried to find out. It's very hard to figure out who actually wrote it, because we know that the president doesn't write it, and we certainly know that for this president. But somebody wrote this for him, and the language starts out with saying, I have all this authority. And in addition to the departments and agencies, look at Section 1, specified in the said act of August 26, 1950. We'll get to that in a little while. And then an executive order that is not particularly important or relevant. The provisions of that act, a statute, shall apply. So this is interesting. Something has happened between 1945 and 1953, which is a congressional statute that the President of the United States suddenly sees as very useful for dropping a security clearance system over the entire federal government. The appointment of each civilian officer or employee in any department or agency of the government shall be made subject to investigation. And the criteria are listed in Section 8. Later in the order, it turns out that, so textually, these criteria are prioritized over desirous of the revolutionary overthrow of the United States, for instance. So there's a bunch of other criteria. It turns out that you've decided that you want to overthrow the United States by violence. We'll get rid of you, too. But in the meantime, we're going to find out whether you have any behavior, activities, or associations which will show that you're not reliable or trustworthy, any deliberate misrepresentations, falsifications, or omissions of material facts. That's the provision that Jared Kushner completely ignored and Michael Flynn. Any criminal, infamous, dishonest, immoral, or notoriously disgraceful conduct, that's drawn from the Civil Service Act of 1883. Habitual use of intoxicants to excess, drug addiction, or sexual perversion. So that's the reference to homosexuality. And now there are many other things going on in the executive order. It's not an executive order mainly about homosexuality. But what's clearly happened is that from 1945 to 1953, there's been a transformation in the preoccupations of the people in Washington. And the President of the United States has decided to think about sexual orientation and the sexual orientation of the people who work for the United States. The military has already done this, but now this has happened in the civilian sector. So it turns out that there isn't any other literature that asks the question that I've asked here, or those two questions, in precisely the way that I've asked them. So that's one thing that you need to know. But that isn't to say that there isn't a literature that bears directly, and that I have found enormously helpful and interesting and useful to me in trying to understand what happened. Okay, now my story is going to be different about what happened than the story that exists about what happened that can be extended to this case. But let me tell you what the existing, and I hate to say this in front of my dear colleague Bruce Dorsey, who is an historian, but I'm going to be a little hard on historiography, even though I'm also incredibly indebted to the historians. So it's political regulation of sexuality is the argument. There's a whole literature about how in the immediate post-war period there was an elite preoccupation with containing the new explorations in sexuality and sexual freedom and sexual expression that had occurred starting in the 1930s that really began to take off in the 1940s and that were the backstory for the Kinsey Report, in which reported that Americans were incredibly sexually active in all kinds of ways that nobody knew about. And the person who made the argument that this, what was really going on was top-down, and I'm using this quite advisedly, straightening out of society, was John D'Amelio, who is a great historian from the University of Illinois, and he's now in retirement, and he's the person who argued that what is really going on is that a lot of history is over the regulation of sexuality. Right? We have class conflict, we have other kinds of conflict, but we also have conflict over sexual expression and sexual freedom. And that's a motor, an historical motor. And one of the things that's happening here is that straight elites are scared and they're using the state to crack down on new forms of sexual expression. A very good and fantastic 2004 book was made into a movie. I'm so jealous. And this movie is now available. And the guy is David K. Johnson is an LGBT historian at University of Central Florida, and this book is based on this. The movie is based on his book, The Lavender Scare, and on the University of Chicago website, University of Chicago Press website, there's a wonderful interview, and the interviewer asks him, you know, what's going on, what happened then, and he says at the end, very emphatically, we shouldn't forget that the Lavender Scare was a reaction to an earlier time of openness and visibility for the gay community. Such periods of progress are always subject to a backlash. Again, very similar to the domestic containment argument. There is a very subtle and sophisticated argument by the historian Margot Kennedy, teaches at Princeton University. This book actually won an award from the American Political Science Association, The Straight State, and has a great title. I wish it took me a while to figure out what could I come up with that would be just as good. I'm not sure that Uncle Sam's Closet is just as good, but I'm hoping it's a contender. But she got to the straight state first, and what she shows in the straight state is that starting in the early 20th century, officials and all kinds of agencies are finding men and women who just seem real different. And they don't have any vocabulary, they don't know what, they just know that they're different. And so they start trying to come up with language and labels, they start trying to figure out, how do we understand who these people are? And what they do over a period of 20, 30, 40 years is that the state constructs the binary. The binary didn't exist until the state constructed it. Incredibly daring argument that the binary is the construction of bureaucrats. No wonder she won a prize. And in fact, that she says that the construction of the binary really begins to get going in the 1940s during World War II. Very exciting claim. So quickly did the impetus to police homosexuality spread across the federal bureaucracy. And this is a marvelous phrase. It turns out to be wrong. But it turned, okay, I hope to persuade you of this, that it might seem as though a switch was suddenly thrown during the World War II period. So this is a critical mass argument that she's making. And then there's this absolutely wonderful book. This also was made into a documentary, Coming Out Under Fire. One of the little known, but for LGBTQ historians this is well known, but for most people this isn't known. The expansion of the military during World War II meant that the military was incredibly gay friendly. All these men and women were pulled into the military. About 5,000 were kicked out, that's true. But throughout the military, it was widely recognized that many of the people whom you were fighting with, if you were straight, were either lesbians or homosexuals. And that there was no particular shame about this. They're off base, they would be in gay bars or in lesbian bars. And the military police didn't worry about this. The officers didn't worry about this. The top brass didn't worry about this. Some did, and they stuck people in what were called queer stockades in some bases in the Pacific. But for most of the military was was wide open to people being different and not having to hide it. It was a liberalization. And that's why it's called Coming Out Under Fire. And one other little note, it turns out that the military psychiatry comes into its own. Military psychiatrists were asked, hey, is this a problem for us? And military psychiatrists came back and said, no. I mean, you know, everybody's different. People have all kinds of issues. And this kind of, they understood it clearly as a clinical problem, right? So to that extent, it was homophobic. But it was no different than any of the number of other clinical problems that soldiers and men and women in uniform would have. So there's a crackdown. Okay, so again, the political regulation of sexuality. So the Department of Defense in 1949 suddenly says, it's all over, done. And by the way, you don't get to enjoy any of the GI Bill either. Okay, so we're going to give you a certain slip, which is an incredibly cruel thing to do because it means then you can't get a job. And you can't make your way back into the employment market. So that's why a lot of people ended up in cities and tried to find ways of working that as best they could. So there's a bottom-up explanation that political scientists, in my experience, always like. And you won't find this explanation really in the historiography, which is very elite-centered and very top-down. But in the political scientists, when I give this talk, political scientists say, well, wasn't there a moral panic? Or, you know, didn't society really want this? And one person at a talk I gave said, Bayard Rustin was arrested on a beach in Los Angeles. There was a moral panic. People were really upset about gay visibility and gay expression. And so in that story, the state is responding to society. So the different versions of the argument. Let me just run through some problems that I think these arguments face. One is, no one said, in so many words, let's regulate sexuality in order to straighten out our society. No one said it. There was a lot of bigotry, there was a lot of homophobia, there was a lot of fear, there was a lot of hatred, but there wasn't anything sophisticated going on. Like, gee, we have to reshape society and recast it. There was elite hysteria, but it was mainly confined to one party, the Republican Party, and for reasons that have to do with party competition. There was no switch thrown. That is to say, there were just too many bureaucracies for that to happen. Sex perverts were not a campaign issue in 1950 or 1952. Let me just go a little bit further into this. This is federal civilian employment as a percentage of government employment as a percentage of the civilian labor force, and you can see that there's just an enormous increase. So right away, Kennedy's argument that switch was thrown. She's right about the agencies that she looks at, but the idea that this happened in all the agencies There were federal agencies that were suddenly growing all over the place, emergency agencies. So this is one of the reasons why, even though I love the book, and even though I think the argument is very daring and very interesting, the argument that suddenly there's this critical mass of bureaucracies, and that was the foundation for what Eisenhower did in 1953, doesn't seem to me to actually work as a kind of causal arrow. And as for social hysteria, well, there was social hysteria in Los Angeles. This is taken from William Eskridge, Gay Law, The Apartheid of the Closet, from one of his appendices, Appendix C1, C2, and these are sodomy arrests. He's a very assiduous researcher, and you find a slight uptick in sodomy arrests, but you don't see an explosion in sodomy arrests. And so the moral panic story that the political scientists like really can't wash. Well, the political scientists think, well, there must be an opinion survey. Okay, yeah, there is an opinion survey. It's really weird. It turns out that at the same time that there was this preoccupation about sexual orientation going on in Washington, state legislatures were very worried about people like Judge Roy Moore. And which, that is to say, they were worried about pedophilia, they were worried about violent rape, they were very worried. In other words, now that we had schools, now that people were in daycare, and now we had people in suburbs, in strange locations, there was a surge across the state legislatures. And so these reputable surveys, the National Election Survey and the University of Chicago survey, NORC, asked people, and this is a very weird question, it came out of a reading of Theodor Adorno, and they took this directly from Theodor Adorno's research on the authoritarian personality, and as an experiment, the NES and NORC put this question in, and the question is totally weird. Sex criminals deserve more than prison, which is what the policy that the state legislatures were producing was. They should be whipped publicly or worse. Prison is too good for sex criminals. They should be publicly whipped or worse. So you could make an argument that this is tapping moral panic about sexual expression. But what we know from surveys is that the survey has to be real clear before you can make any inferences about what the survey is actually telling you. And so this isn't to say that the moral panic argument or the switch thrown argument or the political regulation of sexuality argument is off. I'm just saying that I think we need to supplement the story, and that's what I propose to do. Okay? And I certainly believe that the people in the Eisenhower administration and the people in Congress whom you're about to see, they were acting in a context which favored their action. That is to say, if people had known about what they were doing and had followed it closely, and it was a subject of mass discussion, they wouldn't have disapproved. I think that's certainly true. So here's my roadmap. What did happen? There was bureaucratic, so what we'll see next is bureaucratic propagation of security risk, of the security risk idea. There's a new idea that begins to take over official Washington besides loyalty. As that bureaucratic propagation happens, members of oversight committees, especially the committee that oversees the State Department, want to know what's happening to the security risk idea and its implementation. And so what happens is that then there is an alarmed discovery by Republicans in 1950 of the fact that there are sex perverts. And the Truman administration and congressional Democrats agree that security risk criteria ought to be applied in 13 agencies. So that's the statute that Eisenhower was referring to from summer 1950. And they pass a statute, and Truman signs it. And everywhere else, there is no issue. But on a separate track, the Senate is calling for total expulsion of sex perverts. So there's a hybrid loyalty security risk model by 1952, and there are people who are saying that's not enough, we need to go all the way, and they're very concerned about sexual orientation. And then we'll see that Eisenhower makes a big difference. I think that Eisenhower was studying what was happening very carefully, and once it was clear to him that he could win the nomination, it was also, I think, very clear to him that he would be the next president, and he would be thinking about this because it was an open seat. Truman wasn't running, and Republicans had been waiting for five presidential elections. Their time was going to come, and it was going to be 1952. So take a look at some initial statutes. These are summary dismissal statutes that were intended to be applied to security risks. And here is the security risk idea taking off in the New York Times. The New York Times had a tool called the Chronicle tool in which you could enter a phrase and another phrase, and then you would get a plot that would show you on the y-axis the percentage of stories by year. And you can see that it begins to take off in 1950, and then during the Eisenhower administration, security risk takes up 20%. You'll find the phrase in 20% of New York Times stories. So this is an idea that didn't exist, it wasn't on the radar screen, and suddenly takes off, and in the 1950s is a hugely important idea. I didn't get the actual origin of this. I just wanted to show with this piece of a clip from an AP story that was published in, and I'm not entirely sure at this point what newspaper it was, nor for this, but the idea that I'm trying to get across here is that as the oversight is occurring, the Undersecretary of State for Security Affairs inside the State Department is inveigled into answering a question about, now could you tell us how many people who have been security risks have been dismissed? Well, 202, Mr. Senator. And of those in that special category, you know that special category? Yes, I know what special category you're talking about. Could you tell us how many of those? 91, sir. What were they now? Homosexuals, sir. Homosexuals, you say. That's exactly how the transcript of the hearing goes. And so this guy gets really excited. This guy is a very prominent Republican. He's from Nebraska. He was once considered presidential material. He died in 1952, otherwise you would know him better, because he's an extremely active, extremely talented politician. And he thought he recognized an issue that was just as good as the Red Scare, and that he could make a big deal out of this. And it got him into trouble later. He was inducted into the Nebraska Hall of Fame, and then he was pulled out once it was discovered that he was the Joe McCarthy of gays, that he had led this Lavender Scare. And he, along with another senator, created an initial inquiry. They managed to dream up the idea that there are 3,500 deviants in the District of Columbia alone. There's a cartoon in a Washington newspaper, report to me on the traitors and the queers in my administration that I might tell the people. So suddenly, Washington is agog with this news. There's an editorial in the Washington Post about the aberrants. And the aberrants are very different people. Interestingly, you'll see here, in the past, the State Department in particular was believed to contain colonies of such persons. There was a New Yorker cartoon at the time where someone is at a job interview and he says, yeah, but I left the State Department for other reasons, not for the one you think. So this was widely believed about the State Department. If you've seen the movie about Julia Child, you'll know that there's a hint of the Lavender Scare in the movie. And the Washington Post editorial goes on to say, there are all these people, yeah, and they really are problems because they're susceptible to blackmail. They're not disloyal, it's just who they are, they can't help it. And they're susceptible to blackmail. And so they have to be fired. Right? This is the sober opinion of the Washington newspaper. And so what happens over the summer is that in the wake of this controversy, the Democratic Party decides to come up with a summary dismissal statute. And this is a plot from a database that arrays the votes in two-dimensional space. The basic takeaway is that when someone stands up, makes a motion to take the bill of the summary dismissal statute, send it back to committee, which is to kill it. Actually, a lot of people say, yeah, we should kill it. But then when it wins, everybody says, okay, we're on board with the summary dismissal statute. And the Chicago Tribune writes a story about it, and then you'll see the subtitle that it's a bill aimed at perverts. So what's happened then is that the Congress, the Democratic Party, has decided to rationalize summary dismissal authority, extend it to 13 agencies, and the president has signed this. But we'll get back to this in just a second. But the result is that there's a hybrid system. There's a loyalty system left over from Truman's loyalty boards, and there's a security risk system. And Truman has his director of the National Institute of Mental Health give seminars at the White House in which he explains that it's okay for us to have this system because sex perverts are security risks in security sensitive agencies, so we'll kick them out. But everywhere else, we're not going to bother them. That's what the director of the National Institute of Mental Health says. Trust me, I'm a psychiatrist. I run the National Institute for Mental Health. I'm an expert. We don't have to worry about this. But senators, in part because of Query, that guy that we saw earlier, have decided, okay, we're going to have a hearing. We're going to have this. We're going to look into this. And they issue a report in which the report is written by an FBI agent who's the staffer, the general counsel, and he just writes it. They don't want to touch what he writes. McCarthy didn't even want to be on the committee. And he simply writes, we'll just have to get rid of them. And so by 1952, there is something of a debate. Well, gee, what are we going to do? We've got some senators who want to fire everyone who's a sex pervert if we can find them. And then there are other people who are happy, and the Truman White House is happy with the hybrid system. And Truman realizes, okay, I'm going to punt on this. I'm going to have a study commission. And he creates a commission that studies it, and the study commission meets and basically says, yeah, there should be some sort of rationalization. It turns out that Eisenhower, in his memoir about this period, says, I was watching, and I was really thinking about this. He claims in the memoir, falsely, that the public was demanding a change. I can't find a single Eisenhower speech in which he refers to what he does. During the political campaign, I pledged to do just this, having been openly critical of the government's attitude. Can't find it. I mean, maybe it's on radio somewhere, I just haven't got the tape, but I can't find it. Loyalty is only an aspect of security. I felt that the double standard program to be inadequate. It appeared to me to reflect either a complacency or skepticism towards security risks in government. He's really actually genuinely worried, is one way to interpret this, about security risks in the government. The platform says we will overhaul loyalty and security programs. Immediately after inauguration, I set to work to close the gap in our defenses. It is important to realize that many loyal Americans, by reason of instability, alcoholism, and I emphasize homosexuality, or previous tendencies to associate with communist front groups, are unintentional security risks. They become subjected to the threat of blackmail by enemy agents. He issues the executive order that we saw earlier. And why are they so confident about actually being able to suddenly, within a month, make this work? It's because Truman has already organized every agency to set up a loyalty board. So if you instruct every agency to set up a security board, they've done it already, right? They've been through a dress rehearsal. So the takeaway, okay, this is the part where I was worried about whether Bruce was going to show up. So I think the political regulation story, regulation of sexuality story, is wrong because the story emphasizes so much intentionality to straighten out society. Whereas the story that I've told is that there was an establishment of a government-wide orientation boundary in addition to the military crackdown. Okay, but I see it much more conjuncturally as coming in part because of the unusual nature of the New Deal hegemony, the Democratic Party's hegemony, such that Republicans were looking for anything. Query was desperate. He was a homophobe, but he was desperate for anything. And just as McCarthy was looking for anything to discredit the Democratic Party. And there was going to be a successor to Truman once Truman decided he wasn't going to run. It's not clear to me that Truman could have won if he decided to run again. But once he was through, there was no question that a Republican was going to win. Political science tells us. In an open seat election, the probability of a change in party is 0.5. So Meanwhile, there's an ideological discussion and some very weird ideas. Susceptibility to blackmail, security risk. People are doing this kind of strange work. It's different from the binary construction work that Mario Candidate talks about. And there's an acute elite awareness of anxiety. They're tremendously paranoid. And we have to remember, this doesn't excuse it, but we do have to remember that, in fact, there were very serious instances of espionage, and that the atomic bomb was given to the Soviets by communists. So the idea, the conversation in official Washington about how to make the government invulnerable in a dangerous geopolitical context was interlaced with homophobia and hatred and bigotry, but it was also interlaced with geopolitical anxiety and with concerns about making sure that we have a government that is literally impenetrable, right? That's what Eisenhower really had in mind, a kind of cordon sanitaire around the government. Government stigma and humiliation of gay women, men and women certainly was an effect of this, and it's no accident that you begin to see gay rights consciousness emerge for the first time with the Mattachine Society, founded by Harry Hay in Los Angeles. There is a gay veterans association that briefly exists in New York City. Its records have disappeared. The first work of gay political thought since Walt Whitman, Donald Webster Corey, which is a fantastic book, weird in many ways, in the sense that it's written in a kind of John Gunther inside homosexual America style. And then there are all these passages about democracy that are incredibly interesting. And so we begin to see so in that sense, the argument that people like Alan Barabay or David Johnson made, which is that this what's happening at the top begins to create a politics which eventually leads to a long quest to change the American government so that LGBT people can serve openly. And that quest did not end until 2011. At one time, it was not axiomatic, as a federal judge said, that sexual orientation has no relevance to a person's capabilities as a citizen. At one time, this was not axiomatic at all. It was very contested. And the contest begins in the 60s. What I've taken you into is a time when the opposite idea was taken very seriously and came to govern public and military administration. So thank you. And I think I told you that I wasn't going to talk this long, but I ended up talking this long. So anyway, I did end within 45 minutes or 40 minutes. So thank you.